The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is the last live show from Edstone for a while. We've got some feast travels coming up, so many of us. Tomorrow is the Day of Atonement, and we've got a mystery substitute lined up for that. And then a mixture of one or two substitutions and some greatest hits from the past year or so. Actually, I think most of them that we'll replay have been fairly recent programs. So that'll be on the schedule on the docket here for the next couple of weeks. And the next time that you hear from me live, I'll be in Edmond at our headquarters studio for a few days after the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day. So that's the schedule in the next couple of weeks. For today's program, we have a lot to get to. There's a an article in the latest Trumpet magazine, my father's article. It's amazing how many times that that magazine comes out, and then these articles that were produced weeks in advance, sometimes months in advance, they end up just being so very timely. His article on the Holy Roman Empire going public, big time, well, we'll tie that together with some upcoming celebrations going on in Aachen, Germany. We've talked before about this city and its history. And it's, as I say, it's interesting that it's in the news now, even as my father's article lands in mailboxes. Also, just speaking of Germany, quite a few stories today on the push for Germany to establish a permanent military base in the Middle East, to take on a more aggressive posture in Syria, in Iraq. I mean, Germany's presence in the Middle East, we know that this is significant when it comes to Bible prophecy. That's something that we certainly want to keep our eyes on. And then if we have some time, if we don't, I'll push this back to after the break. But there's a great chapter right at the end of the United States and Britain in prophecy about what is prophesied to befall our nations. Some great material in that section of Mr. Armstrong's book. Well, on Sunday in the New York Times, I believe this was on the front page, but the title said, "The economy is humming, but Trump is tweeting, and Republicans are worried." This is the way the major media is handling the resurgence, the booming economy. They're acknowledging it to some degree. Of course, you remember a couple of weeks ago, it was Barack Obama who said that he deserved credit for this resurgence. And as if right on cue, the White House, this is from last week, someone sent this to me the other day, but the White House sent out one of its economic advisors, Kevin Hassett. He was sent out last week to talk about the booming economy and to point out who exactly deserves credit for this. This is clip one.
If you see a break of the trend in the capital spending, the new plant formation that gives blue-collar workers their jobs, go to the next slide, please, then maybe we see a break of the trend in blue-collar workers' employment as well. And so this is employment for people in goods-producing industries. If you look again at the blue part on the left, you can see that there's a clear downward trend going on in the growth rate of that for President Obama, and then a clear inflection timed almost precisely once again at the election. And the notion, again, that somebody might defensively attempt to assert that this is a continuation of the trend is almost laughable if you look at this chart. And
almost laughable to say that this was going on before President Trump showed up. Sam and I both think this guy is the perfect spokesman to have when talking about bright, cheery economic news. He has such a cheerful countenance, was smiling all the way through, even as reporters. One in particular says, "Now, come on, Barack Obama just made this speech, and then you come out with all of this. I mean, isn't this supposed to be some kind of a response to his speech?" I mean, they hate it. They hate the fact that there's some positive things going on. They hate the fact that Donald Trump could possibly get some of the credit for this. And so they carry on with their attacks. The economy is humming, but Trump is tweeting, and the Republicans are worried. The attacks, as we've been covering in the last couple of shows, the attacks just keep right on coming. Ignore the resurgence and just attack the president and just attack this administration. The California governor, Jerry Brown, he was on, I believe Andrea Mitchell is on CNN, but they had an exchange yesterday following, once again, the tweet about Puerto Rico. They can't let it go. They're obsessed with this tweet. It's been frontline news for the past 5-6 days. But here is Andrea Mitchell asking Jerry Brown about the tweet. And then listen to what Brown has to say in response. Clip 2.
Now, as a governor, how do you feel when the president of the United States says that nearly 3,000 people did not die in Puerto Rico, even though it was the result of a scientific study, and says that it was a Democratic conspiracy to claim all these deaths?
Well, the problem is we never had a president who is engaged in this kind of behavior. I mean, he's not telling the truth. He keeps changing his mind. He's, sabotaging the world order in many respects. So it's unprecedented. It's dangerous. And hopefully this election is going to send a strong message to the country. The Democrats will win. And then Trump, something's got to happen to this guy. Because if we don't get rid of him, he's going to undermine America and even the world.
That's one of America's 50 governors saying that something's got to happen to this guy, that the president, we've got to get rid of him. He's undermining America. He's sabotaging the world order. So something has to happen to this guy. It's hard to even imagine what a statement like this would have set off a few years ago had it been aimed at Barack Obama. Something has to happen to this guy. We've got to get rid of him. But this, as you've been hearing, you heard it on yesterday's show. It was all over. I mean, all through the weekend. Joe Biden. All the others that I played for you yesterday. John Kerry. Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama. They're all making the rounds. The National Newspaper Publishers Association. This is association that, from what I can tell, it represents black newspapers or publications. It calls itself the most influential black-owned media resource in America. Well, they were giving out awards over the weekend. I think this is actually from Friday last week. And they gave the award to, of all people, Maxine Waters, the one that's out there talking about protesting or confronting Trump cabinet members in restaurants or wherever to publicly shame them. She said that just, I think, back in June. So she's there receiving this award, some kind of award for greatness. And this is how she accepted the reward, or this is at least what she had to say during part of her her acceptance speech. Clip 3.
There are those who say, well, what if we get rid of him? Then we've got that vice president, and he will be worse. I said, knock off the first one, and then go after the second one.
Now, what's interesting about that clip, well, she's talking about, you know, those that would say, well, if you impeach Donald Trump, then we're left with Mike Pence. What if we get rid of Mr. Trump? Well, then we have the vice president, and he'll be worse. Her response is, I say knock off the first one and then go after the second one. Knock off the first one and then go after number two. And then if you notice there, everyone in the National Newspaper Publishers Association starts laughing and cheering. Laughing and cheering. The news media, see, she's on her home turf. It's one and the same. The liberal leftist media and the Democratic Party. the radical leftist Democratic Party. She speaks, well, you hear it in the next clip here. She talks about we politicians and we in the media. This is clip 4.
We have the power. We have the numbers. But we've got to understand our power, and we've got to use our power. Not only do we all have individual power, but just think about the readers that you have, the people who look forward to getting your newspapers, the people who are looking to see if their picture is going to be in it, or their child's picture is going to be in it. Are you going to tell them something about what is going on nationally with some of the people that you have doing the columns in your newspapers? Well, that's all power. Let's use it.
That's Maxine Waters accepting her award from the National Newspaper Publishers Association, saying to these journalists, these publishers, we have the power. We have the power to bring this about. The impeachment. Going after number one and then knocking off number two. We have the power. We've got to use it, she said. As I say, this all comes at a time when you've got the former vice president out there, the former secretary of state, the former attorney general. They're all out there and they're going after Donald Trump. And the media's right in step. I played a couple of clips yesterday from Joe Biden. This one I missed. Here's what he said, I believe, again, Friday or Saturday, over the weekend it was, clip 5.
These forces of intolerance remain determined to undermine and roll back the progress you all have made. This time, they, not you, have an ally in the White House. This time, they have an ally. There are a small percentage of the American people, virulent people. Some of them the dregs of society.
That's what the vice president, the former vice president, has to say about those who voted for President Trump. I played the clip yesterday where he tied Mr. Trump to the white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan, saying that the president said there were good people in those groups. That's what Joe Biden is out there saying, that your president, if you're an American, is a racist. As I quoted from yesterday, that article by my father, we're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and to stay in power. He said they have no respect for the rule of law. They don't respect the rule of law. Yesterday was Constitution Day. You might have seen that. We had an article at thetrumpet.com. And here they're all, as Andrew Miller brought out in his piece, they're all actively working to undermine the Constitution. This is the way the American experiment was set up. The will of the people. They spoke. And there's a lot of people in the United States that they just won't accept it. They look at those who spoke as the dregs of society. That's amazing. That's an astounding little clip from the former vice president. Virulent people. The dregs of society. Well, a lot of them are reacting this way because, as I covered last week, they're being exposed. They're being exposed. Yesterday, the White House announced that they're going to declassify some of those documents that these committees at Congress have been urging the president to release for reasons of transparency. I mean, we want to see. We want to see who was saying what. We want to see how that this was presented to the FISA court to get these warrants so they could spy on Carter Page and really the entire Trump administration. So some of those pages that had all the redactions, they're going to be released, declassified, anytime, I guess, in addition to interviews that Bruce Orr had in connection with the Russian investigation. And I think this made a lot of people on the right quite happy, the Trump administration is going to release all the text messages relating to the Russia investigation. that came from James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, and Bruce Ohr. These are all the main players. And it's going to expose. It's going to expose even further the deep state. The more we see what went on, what led up to the special investigation, the Mueller probe, what happened even before he showed up. As my father said in that article, Saving America from the Radical Left, temporarily, I mean, it's just temporary. But what he said there, the more that's revealed about this, the more you see the corruption at the highest levels of the DOJ or the FBI. And, of course, the left is up in arms, saying that this is an abuse, a clear abuse of power. That's what Adam Schiff said. No more talk about transparency. But now Mr. Trump is getting nervous. He's a guilty man, so he's acting in desperation. Victor Davis Hanson, he had an article, I think it was just today. I mean, he was talking about how the left is using anonymous sources, going back to that anonymous piece in the New York Times from a couple of weeks ago. And then, of course, this anonymous source that then went public on Sunday to try to bring down Brett Kavanaugh. And he wrote this, I think, even before the White House announced that they were going to declassify some of this material. Hanson says, anonymity has never become more disreputable and legitimized. An unidentified source is the new American means that is to be justified by noble progressive ends, often in the context of somehow delegitimizing Donald J. Trump or anyone or anything remotely connected to him. He says further on in the piece, this is toward the end, anonymity has also become an impediment to ending the entire Russia-Trump collusion mythology. Almost every document, listen to this, almost every document that is so painstakingly obtained from a Justice Department or FBI archive appears so heavily redacted as to be worthless. Miscreants are not identified by name, but instead by letters or numbers. The point of redaction is to disconnect the deep state messenger from the incriminating message. So you have all of these things, these nefarious activities going on in the shadows, and then when Congress, who has oversight, when they want the documents, they get them only after this painstakingly long process, and then what few documents they get, there's all these redactions. And you can't even see what's going on. Hanson says, how strange then that some government leaks to the press are replete with names and so damn the innocent like Carter Page. All of this if it's damning evidence or if it's damning information that brings down someone close to Donald Trump or that allows for the illegal wiretapping or whatever else it is, then, if you notice, I mean, all these leaks, and there's a lot of very detailed leaks. When it hurts the current administration, and then when the point he's making is then when Congress wants oversight to look into things, then it's covered up, then it's heavily redacted. It says further on, yet at other times, official government documents use redaction to protect the identity of the culpable. So the final irony of the new cult of anonymity is that not all anonymity is equal. Sometimes they want it, sometimes they don't, you see. If it's to protect their own, well, we've got to keep it anonymous. We can't make that known to the public. It's going to reveal all kinds of methods. It's going to reveal the way that the DOJ does their work. We can't have that revealed. And so they hide behind the anonymity. On the other hand, like he brings out, if it helps their cause, then they will leak anything and everything. never mind national security. It says the Obama National Security Council and others did their best to unmask and quite illegally leak the names of those caught up in surveillance. That was all over the news media. I mean, that's how these things were being exposed early on in the Trump administration. It was the major media. They were exposing themselves. And then you had conservative commentators who were saying, wait a second. The New York Times just said this is being wiretapped? And then, of course, they backed away. Well, I don't need to go over all that history again. But Victor Davis Hanson does a really good job of exposing, again, exposing the hypocrisy, the double standard, two standards of justice. It says either officials in the Justice Department or the FBI or both fed the toady press the names of a number of surveilled Trump campaign personnel. If an official is willing to offer dirt on the current president, then journalists peddle the gossip and innuendo through the use of anonymity to protect, quote-unquote, a valuable source. Yet, if a name is legally protected from disclosure, but its release might fuel an anti-Trump narrative, then it's usually leaked. Then who cares about the person being kept anonymous? Noble progressive ends justify any means necessary to obtain them. And increasingly, he says, anonymity is the preferred method. And so President Trump, as he's been known to do, he fights back. And now here come all of these declassified documents. It'll be interesting to see what's in those redacted portions or in those text messages. It's too bad we don't have some additional programs to put together over the next few days, but we can at least be reading it and keep our eyes on what's happening inside the United States. This article from Fox News, well, I guess I can skip through that, but there's a lot in there about just the back and forth, the left's reaction to the White House decision yesterday to declassify these documents revolving around the so-called Trump-Russian collusion story or narrative. But I just want to refer you again to the article we posted yesterday, Will America Abolish Its Constitution? Because that's really what's under assault here. Andrew refers to the program my father did earlier this year, The Bible and the Constitution. There's a video embedded in the article, and you can go and see that. Switching over to Spectator, this too appeared on Constitution Day, which was yesterday. And the Spectator's pointing out here how that this is the national observance that we really ought to be trumpeting right about now. Yet this year, it says, 2018, it may well be our most important holiday, for the Constitution is threatened more now than at any time since 7 Southern states seceded from the Union and Civil War broke out on April 12, 1861. It is fascinating, that history. I've been reading some about the Civil War and watching an old PBS series on the subject, and to see just how sharp and bitter the divide was and how many people lost their lives in rivers of blood. That happened within the United States. Americans fighting Americans. Spectator says the Constitution makes it clear that everyone, whether in the public or private sector, is equal before the law. Additionally, every elected federal government officeholder, judicial appointee, and executive branch cabinet secretary is required to pledge an oath before assuming office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And so in Andrew Miller's article, I mean, he's got all these quotes from these well-known publications Politico, the New York Times. I mean, they're BuzzFeed. They're giving all of this space, this editorial space to these authors saying, hey, the Constitution's outdated. We need to get rid of it. And as Andrew brings out, whether these people, these critics realize it or not, this rhetoric, it comes straight from Marxist socialism. But here you have all of these government officials, like the Spectator brings out, and they have to pledge an oath to defend the Constitution. Spectator says, so it comes as an unprecedented shock to learn that a significant number of high-ranking U.S. government officials, most appointed during the Obama administration, betrayed their oaths of office and refused to accept the will of the people manifest in Trump's 304 Electoral College vote victory over Clinton's 227 votes. A new civil war has begun, but it's very different from the one fought 157 years ago. I mean, listen to what they're saying. These are not just commentators. These are congressmen and women. These are former presidents, vice presidents, secretary of state, attorney general. And they're out there. They're out there calling for civil war. Right now, it's a little bit different than the one in 1861. It's different from the Civil War of the 1860s. But look where this is leading. Spectator says the FBI and the Justice Department were politically weaponized and FISA courts were repeatedly deceived in an unprecedented effort to destroy a presidential candidate and throw the election to the opponent. When that failed, Spectator writes, Trump was elected, this same cabal continued undeterred in concerted actions to undermine the duly elected president. Only now those actions were tantamount to a coup d'etat. It says, finally, the Constitution was designed and drafted in such a way as to prevent coup-like conditions from ever developing in the U.S., if voting is the sacred right and responsibility of citizenship, elections and honest vote counting are the sacrosanct mechanism for establishing the legitimacy of the government. Voter fraud or nullifying an election by coup are a betrayal of the Constitution and represent the highest crimes and misdemeanors. That's what we're seeing, a betrayal of the Constitution. And the ones out there betraying it, like the ones writing in the New York Times on Constitution Day or in Politico, they're saying that Donald Trump is proof that our Constitution is no longer valid. They're saying that Donald Trump is proof that the U.S. Constitution is no longer relevant. It's outdated. It says here, finally, in Spectator, Donald Trump's persona and style have remained reasonably consistent since he began campaigning, but the frenzy to trash Trump keeps escalating, notwithstanding significant accomplishments in his first 20 months in office, which have greatly improved the economy and restored America's respect on many fronts of the world stage. There is clearly more going on than disagreement with policy choices and dislike of personality. And well, yes, the Spectator's on to something there. I don't think the author quite understands all that is going on out front and behind the scenes. But look, this is a candidate who's been the same pretty much from the moment he came down the escalator until this day. Americans, at least the half that voted for him, they knew what they were getting. They wanted it. They wanted to shake up the system. They wanted to drain the swamp. They wanted to expose the deep state. And so there's been a temporary resurgence. And then you have these intensifying attacks. The frenzy, as the Spectator puts it. It goes on to talk about how that a lot of this, this hatred, a lot of these attacks are no doubt fueled by the fact that this is a president who fights back, who exposes the media dishonesty, the double standards, the bias. And so many of his followers are well aware of how fake the news in so many cases is. Spectator concludes here, Constitution Day is an occasion to remember that equal justice under the law is the standard, that we the people are in charge, and that the federal government should answer to us and not the other way around. Well, see, really what you see in that article, and it's also brought out in Andrew Miller's piece, Will America Abolish Its Constitution? I mean, what we see is this American experiment, 231 years strong, it's unraveling. It's unraveling before our eyes. That's why you have these columns. They're appearing every other week, it seems like now, in Politico, in the New York Times. We've got to get rid of the Constitution. We've got to do away with the law. Andrew Miller says here, such lawlessness is dangerous. Many Americans are growing discontent with the nation's founding charter, but not enough to legally abolish it. So they resort to obstructionism, civil disobedience, and in some cases, outright rioting. How widespread and how violent will this lawless movement get? Well, then he takes you through some prophecies in Isaiah 3 and Isaiah 1, but make sure that you look for that article. It's still near the top of the Trumpet.com website, and also then look for that video. It's within Andrew's piece, The Bible and the Constitution, my father's Key of David program from earlier this year. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I mentioned at the top of the show just how timely so many of my father's articles end up being, even when they're prepared weeks before the actual publication date. An example of this is his latest, The Holy Roman Empire, goes public big time. It goes public, and he talks about some important history in this piece. One of the earliest emperors of the Holy Roman Empire was, as he says here, Charlemagne. His empire included much of what is now France. Well, he gives some of the geography, how big his empire was, and how that Charlemagne founded the Ostmark, a region where the Alps form a natural defensive line against the Eastern Slavic people. And then the Ostmark formed the core of modern Austria, and that's where Austria gets its name today. And so he covers some of the history, what Austria is today celebrating under the leadership of Sebastian Kurz, this Holy Roman Empire heritage, how that it's on display. It's being publicly promoted. My father writes here, correlating with Austria's presidency, the Imperial Treasury in Vienna is offering tours between July 1st and December 31. So this is going on right now. The tours were advertised throughout Vienna with a large picture of the crown of the Holy Roman Empire. Vienna's Imperial Treasury explained that Austria's presidency of the EU Council is the occasion for lively debate about what Europe is and what it should be in the future. The Imperial Treasury in the Vienna Hofburg is well suited as a forum for this discourse, for many of the objects, this is quoting from this this tour, or why, but this is just a perfect place for these many objects to be preserved, and they're directly related to Europe's past. And then my father says, these objects related to the past, okay, what are the objects? And what past are we talking about? Well, it's these crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. Says this exhibit is designed to showcase the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire. It's being promoted throughout Vienna with photos of the imperial crown. This crown is also the main symbol portrayed on the outside of the exhibit. Well, as he says in his title, it's all meant to put the Holy Roman Empire up on display. It's being celebrated now, this history. It's going public, big time. Austria's leaders, this is my father writing, Austria's leaders want people to know about the Holy Roman Empire. There are 28 nations in Europe. Some of those nations may dislike the emphasis on that empire, but watch, he says. Just watch. It's going to be promoted. It's going to be promoted regardless. And it is. And those that are critical, they're just going to be drowned out, those voices. You won't hear them. Well, that, as I say, it fits right in with this this news from today and the upcoming celebrations in Aachen, Germany, a little tiny German community in northwestern Germany. At the end of this month, the end of September, they're going to be setting off a week-long celebration celebrating Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, this is their history. These are their historical roots. This is from the official tourism website for Aachen. It says, the Aachen Cathedral rises up in the center of the old city. The important symbol of the church, or rather the city, was completed in 803 after 20 years of construction and for a long time served as a coronation church. Over 30 German rulers were crowned on the coronation throne from the Carolingian era, which has been preserved until this day. It says the cathedral treasury is one of the most important church treasuries in Europe, not least because visitors can see the bones of Emperor Charlemagne in a cabinet there. This is a cathedral. Well, I've visited it. I visited this a time or two myself. My father brings out in his piece that we actually, a few of us were actually in Aachen back in 1997, over 20 years ago, when they were handing out the Charlemagne Prize to, I think it was Roman Herzog at the time. In any event, I mean, here's more about this celebrated history, the way the Europeans would see it. Deutsche Welle says here regarding the celebrations, it's the most famous for having been built on the orders of Emperor Charlemagne, talking about this famous cathedral, also known as King Charles the Great, during his lifetime, and it has also served as his resting place since his death in 814. Although there was a lot going on, the Carolingian harmony was indisputable from every angle. The one thing I couldn't help but notice was the stunning 4-meter-wide golden Barbarossa chandelier. Further on, it says the importance of the cathedral is further magnified by it having been the coronation venue until 1531 for 31 German kings and 12 queens. The tourism website, switching back to that, talks about this week-long celebration, saying that a visit to Charlemagne's throne will be a moving experience. Visitors can take a look at the throne right up close and come into contact with the history of Charlemagne in a way that will leave a deep impression. This is the direction that Europe is headed in. The Holy Roman Empire goes public big time, as my father brings out. Make sure you read that article in thetrumpet.com or at thetrumpet.com. It's coming out in the October issue of the Trumpet print magazine. But in this piece, I mean, he quotes Otto von Habsburg saying, these are the symbols that we need. I mean, these are the traditions that we need to resurrect, the tradition of Charlemagne, this imperial crown and such. And he quotes from quite a few other sources, more recent sources, German language articles. I mean, they're making no bones about it. They want this. They want to resurrect this. My father refers to that visit that he made to Aachen in 1997. Roman Herzog, he was the one who won the award back then. He was German president at the time. And Herzog, at that ceremony, he said, "Charlemagne, after whom our prize is named, made his own particular choice, the first unification of Europe. At such an hour, the truth must be told. Only by wading through a sea of blood, sweat, and tears did he reach his goal." And my father says, I mean, that's a pretty unusual and frank statement. That's the history. I mean, he did speak the truth, Herzog did, in 1997. The Holy Roman Empire is militaristic through and through. It has been that way for centuries. It's triggered all kinds of bloody wars on the continent. And yet, how many people are going to be getting that bit of the history? Instead, as you see, it's a great celebration. Well, as I say, this is happening even as you see all these other headlines about Germany considering a permanent base for the Bundeswehr in the Middle East. Spiegel has an article today. Germany faces new pressure to take military role in Syria. And where's that pressure coming from? It's coming from the United States. We're saying, look, take the lead, Germany. Build an army, Germany. Establish a base, Germany. Take on a more aggressive stance against Syria, Germany. And Germany's stepping up. Deutsche Welle says the German foreign minister, she's urging long-term military presence in Iraq as well. All of these movements, all of these advances, even as Europe works, Germany and Austria in particular, as they work to resurrect their history, infamous history, Charlemagne's history, wading through rivers of blood, a sea of blood. That's what European leaders, that's what these nationalist leaders in Europe, that's what they want. This is what they want to return to, that kind of glory and power, the way that they see it. And isn't it amazing that you have the United States pushing them in that direction? When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a short Bible study built around that 14th and final chapter of the United States and Britain in prophecy. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical. But world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In chapter 14 of the United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert Armstrong, he goes through several verses from Micah, the book of Micah in the Old Testament, chapter 5. If you want to get your Bible and read along with me, we can just look through some of these verses. But early on in the chapter, Mr. Armstrong says here, "Just as God has bestowed on us such material blessings as never before came to any nations, now to correct us so we may enjoy such blessings, he's going to bring upon our people such national disaster as has never before struck any nation." That is coming. The resurgence is only temporary, and you see the seeds being planted for civil war, as I covered in the first segment. God gave us all of these blessings, blessings that have never come upon any nations like ours, the United States and Britain in particular. But now he must correct us. Micah 5 and verse 7, it says, "And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the eternal, as the showers upon the grass, that tarries not for man, but nor waits for the sons of men." The remnant of Jacob refers to our modern-day nations of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain in prophecy. All of this wealth, all of this power, all of this abundance, showers upon the grass, agricultural productivity, blessings from God. Verse 8, it continues, "And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many people, as a lion among the beasts of the forest, as a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who, if he goes through, both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver." Here are Ephraim and Manasseh. They're likened to a lion among the other nations of the earth. One was a great worldwide empire, and the other the greatest superpower the world's ever seen. It was our nations, primarily for the better part of two centuries, that preserved the Western world in two great world wars. It was our nations, primarily, that prevented the Holy Roman Empire from dominating our peoples, from enslaving our peoples. It's been our nations that have, for the most part, maintained relative peace since the end of World War II. Verse 9 says, "Your hand shall be lifted up upon your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off." All of our enemies cut off since the time that those birthright blessings were bestowed upon us back in the early 1800s, all the way through great national struggles in the case of the Civil War, worldwide struggles, World War I and World War II. But then, like Mr. Armstrong explains in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, look at what has happened since the end of World War II. Great Britain, of course, lost its empire. And every war that the United States gets involved in or has gotten involved in since, it's just been from one quagmire to the next, starting with the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and on it goes. But going back to those first couple of verses there, I mean, what a blessing. What a blessing the United States and Britain have been for the rest of the world. As I say, it's our nations that have rescued other nations. You look at the Hoover program following World War I and how many millions of lives it saved. people that would have died from starvation. And then the Marshall Plan following World War II, rebuilding Europe, rebuilding Germany, Japan. In his article from August, The August Trumpet, Joel Hilliker says here, over the past 200 years, this is fascinating history to reflect on because you've seen the rise and the fall. Mr. Hilliker says here, over the last 200 years, life expectancy for a human being has increased from about 30 years to 71 years. Infant mortality has plummeted from 33% to 6%. Infectious diseases, undernourishment, and catastrophic famines are disappearing, even in poor countries. Poverty is declining. The world is now about 100 times wealthier than it was in the early 1800s. Two centuries ago, only 12% of the world could read and write. Today, it's 86%. Now, a lot of this was due to the promises of blessings and prosperity that God bestowed upon our nations due to Abraham's obedience. And those blessings, that prosperity, so much of it, I mean, it did spread around the earth. It did positively impact other nations besides Ephraim and Manasseh. That's what Mr. Hilliker is bringing out there. And then, as I said a moment ago, the preservation of peace and stability, the rescue, salvation from two great world wars, from tyranny, from communism. But verse 10, it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal, that I will cut off your horses out of the midst of you. I will destroy your chariots, and I will cut off the cities of your hand and throw down all your strongholds." I'm going to cut off your armaments of war. I'm going to cut off your cities. He says in chapter 14, Mr. Armstrong does, here God identifies the great peoples of the earth who are the most wealthy and beneficent, the most powerful, yet at the very time their power reaches its zenith, he suddenly breaks the pride of their power, cuts off their implements of war, and destroys their cities. Why? Why does this happen? Well, verse 12 says, "And I will cut off witchcrafts out of your hand, and you shall have no more soothsayers. Your graven images also will I cut off, and your standing images out of the midst of you. And you shall no more worship the work of your hands." See, false ministers, witchcraft, idolatry. We fancy ourselves, particularly in America, we fancy ourselves as being pretty religious. There's that prophecy in Amos 7 about the king's chapel. Very religious indeed. It's going to come to a collision of sorts, that religious movement, with God's true religion. I don't have time to get into the Amos 7 prophecy, but you can study that on your own in the Great Again booklet, the chapter on Jeroboam. But God says here through his prophet, verse 14, "And I will pluck up your groves out of the midst of you, so I will destroy your cities, and I will execute vengeance and anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard." Jacob's trouble, I mean, ultimately it leads into worldwide trouble. God's punishment coming upon all nations. I mean, salvation is given first to Israel, and so is corrective punishment. That's what Mr. Armstrong covers in U.S. and Britain. As he says in chapter 14, there is no other people that even remotely fulfills this great prophecy, but the American and British Commonwealth peoples fulfill it precisely. It's all leading into great tribulation, but there is hope beyond that nightmare. Joel Hilliker had a piece that he posted just the other day. You can believe in Christ's second coming. He speaks in that article, or writes in that article, about the many prophecies in the Old Testament about the second coming of Christ And then the many prophecies in the New Testament. Jesus Christ himself in John 14 saying, if I go, I'm coming again. And then laying out all of these end time events that lead up to his second coming. Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. And Jesus in all those prophecies pleading with us to watch. Watch and pray always. Watch for it. Matthew 24, verse 27, it says, for as the lightning comes out of the east and shines even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. And then down in verse 30, here is that blessed event. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. If you want to study into this more, you can look at the Wonderful World Tomorrow book. The prophecies before that, of course, my father's booklet on nuclear Armageddon is at the door. But together with that, be sure to study the Wonderful World of Tomorrow, what it will be like. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This will be the last time that you hear from me for a few weeks or a couple weeks, almost 2 weeks, but we'll be raring to go when we're back in action at our headquarters studio. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.